This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. When Thomas Jefferson ran for president, political opponents spread stories that he took his slave, Sally Hemings, as his concubine and fathered her children. For hundreds of years, most historians dismissed that as myth. 11 years ago, DNA proved it as fact. The ensuing uproar forced many people to look again at Thomas Jefferson, his complexities and his contradictions. But as so often happens in slavery, there was very little said about the slaves, about Sally Hemings, her siblings, and her children. In her new book, Annette Gordon-Reed turns the Hemings to flesh. She pieces together the story of their lives from records that Jefferson himself kept and from the writings of several Hemings themselves. What emerges is both a portrait of a family and of slavery before, during, and after the Revolution. Later in the hour, we're going to continue our series on This American Moment with Randall Kennedy, who wonders what African-Americans will feel if Barack Obama loses. But first, if you have questions about Sally Hemings, what her life was like, and what life was like for slaves at Jefferson's Monticello, give us a call. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Annette Gordon-Reed is the author of The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family, and she's with us here today in Studio 3A. It's great to have you here in the studio.
It's great to be here.
So what do we know actually about Sally Hemings?
Well, we know the year she was born. We know her parentage. We know a little bit about her family life. It's a very difficult thing to piece together because, as you mentioned, as we know, slaves did not, for the most part, keep records, letters that have remained until this particular point. What we know of her, we know from Jefferson's records, pretty much. And she was a woman who was a quarter black. She was described, mainly when people talk about her, they talk about what she looked like, mm-hmm. as they often do with women. She was described as very attractive. One description of her had her as industrious and orderly. Abigail Adams described her when she was a young woman, as a young girl, I should say, as good-natured. So those are pretty much the things that we have in the way of what other people said about her appearance and some statements about her character. And we know, again, more of records of where she lived and where she was at various times, but nothing from her herself.
We do know that she also bore a striking resemblance to Jefferson's wife, Martha.
Well, people think she might have. She was Martha's half-sister, and half-sisters do resemble one another, and not only in their looks, but in their mannerisms and so forth. But there was this family connection, this sort of old Virginia mixed-up family connection going there that intrigues people.
And it is a story that goes back to her mother and her relations with the man who owned her.
Yes.
And indeed, it's a story that is about the landed gentry of Virginia.
Yes. Elizabeth Hemings was the daughter of an Englishman and an African woman. When she came into the ownership of a man named John Wales, who fathered her children, six of her children, one of whom was Sally, who was the youngest among them. So it is about slavery. I mean, most people think of slavery, or many people tend to think of slavery as just an economic system, mm-hmm. people buying and selling people, the auction block, those kinds of things. But it was also a time when there were mixed families because of the proximity between whites and blacks during that time.
You also point out in the book that most of our suppositions about slavery date from antebellum, pre-Civil War slavery in the Deep South, mm-hmm. when cotton was king, and that indeed it was a very different system in Virginia around the Revolutionary War.
Yes,
period.
Slavery was an institution that evolved over time. The different crops that people grew and where slaves worked, how they worked. So you're right. I mean, people think of it mainly as Gone with the Wind and Terra, but this is the era of the colonial era of tobacco and the changeover to wheat in the 1780s and the 1790s. So there were many different types of slavery, different and sort of evolutions in the system over the time here in America.
You also, in passing, and by the way, if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, email us, talk@npr.org. We're talking with Annette Gordon-Reed about her new book, The Hemingses of Monticello. Along the way, you give about the most interesting description of why we celebrate the landing at Plymouth Rock and not Jamestown, which, of course, was earlier than Plymouth Rock, about the clearest theory as to why we do that I've ever read.
Well, you know, Plymouth is a much better story. It's a much more uplifting story, people coming over to escape religious persecution versus people coming over to make a buck, really, which is what the Virginia Company was about. And there's nothing wrong with making a buck, but it's not the sort of lofty aspirations that you would prefer, that most people would prefer to associate with the founding of a country.
And even though the Pilgrim Fathers were very quickly excluding people
yes,
who did not agree with them.
Well, yeah, they weren't very tolerant themselves. Yes.
It is nothing compared to the story of how the economic development of Virginia soon transformed into such a system based on violence.
Yes, exactly. I mean, they began with indentured servants, and very, very early on when that first Africans arrived, switched for a number of reasons. The population sort of implosion in Europe. I mean, it was difficult to get people to come over after a particular time, and then it was cheaper to import slaves, and that became the predominant mode of production in Virginia.
And some of the other fascinating issues that you explore along the way in telling the story of the Hemings family include why, and this has always puzzled a lot of people in the Revolutionary War, blacks did not take up cause, or many blacks did not take up cause with the British.
Well, actually, a number of them did.
Yes, some did.
And the British offered them freedom. Mainly, people were able to get to the north. Mainly blacks in the north were involved with the loyalist cause and whatsoever. But there was a great amount of power and sort of a fear among the Virginians in particular that more would in fact take up arms and go with the British. A number of them followed them along the way. But
about half the population of the state was slaves.
Yeah,
at the time,
yeah. It was, you know, we think of sort of early America as white, but this really. I wanted to convey in the book that particularly Virginia was, it was English and it was an African place during the colonial times.
800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Deirdre joins us on the line from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Hi, I have a question for the author. In my minority relations class last semester at ORU in Tulsa, we read a piece by one of Sally Hemings' children who is only an eighth black, and he talks about how some of his siblings passed into white society. And I wanted to know if the author had any comments about this or find out if this was true.
Well, the person you're referring to is Madison Hemings. He gave his yes. recollections of life at Monticello. Yes, and they were one-eighth black. And his three of his siblings did, in fact, go into the white world. And two of them we know nothing about. Their descendants, because they totally disappeared. Another one of his siblings, Eston Hemings, was in the black community for a time, and that's why we're able to trace him, because he spent time in the black community and he wasn't really hiding. He left Ohio and decided to move to Wisconsin, and he took the last name Jefferson, and the family changed his name and identity and became white people. And yeah, you know, so they definitely did do that. There's a lot of controversy about this kind of thing because
right.
some blacks feel that it's traitorous. But on the other hand, if you think about it, if you are white enough to look like a white person and you're living in a time when blacks can't vote, when their children, you know, could not go to schools, you know, it would be a tough thing to ask someone who had the chance for his, you know, for their children to do something better to remain in the black community. But of course, Madison Hemings did. And some of his, you know, descendants prospered and they did well. But it's tough being black in America. And so I'm not as sort of down on them for doing that as I've heard some people be. But it's definitely a true story that they did pass into the white world.
Great. Well, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate your input.
Thanks very much. There were also, as you write, some members of her family who could have passed for white and chose not to.
Yes, yes. And we don't know why, but maybe it was a sense of solidarity with the black race. The other thing that happens when you pass for white is that you really have to give up your family. It's not just about leaving a race. It's leaving your mother and your siblings behind. You can't have family reunions. You can't visit because it would then sort of betray or tell people about your heritage. So I think some people, it's difficult for people to give up their families.
And speaking of controversy, some people would take it as a given that any sexual relationship between a master and a slave would be rape by definition. You argue maybe not all the time.
Not all the time, just because I think from a historian's perspective, you can't say that all of anything was ever all any one thing. I mean, certainly Sally Hemings' sisters, and I talk about her relationship in sort of a comparison to her sister Mary, who lived with a man who owned her just as much as Jefferson owned Sally Hemings, but she asked to live with this man, and they lived together as husband and wife. He left her property and recognized their children, but they had the legal relationship of master and slave. So it's sort of hard to see how that was more like the traditional understanding of the most prevalent relationships between blacks and whites, when it's pretty clear from these people's actions and words that they did not consider themselves to be in that type of relationship.
And Sally Hemings herself could have stayed in France, where she would have been treated as a free person.
She could have stayed in France and taken her freedom there. There were, in the 18th century, hundreds of people who filed freedom suits in France, and every single petition that was filed was granted because the Admiralty Court and the Parliament upheld what was called the freedom principle. That is to say that there should be no slaves in France. Now, they had slaves in the French colonies, but they didn't want it in France proper. So she could have stayed there. She and her brother, who sometimes we forget that she was not by herself. Her brother was 24 years old. He'd been trained in some of the best kitchens in France as a chef, and had hired a tutor to teach them proper French. And so there was a possibility they could have stayed there.
And do we know why they elected not to?
Well, that's the question people always ask me. I think, well, the story that Madison Hemings told about his mother is that Jefferson promised that she would have a decent life if she would come back. He would take care of her and that he would free her children. James Hemings, probably when Jefferson came home originally, he thought he might be going back. He must have come to some sort of deal with James Hemings. He does later on in writing that if he trained a person at Monticello to be a chef, then he would have his freedom, which is what happened.
Did Jefferson keep his word in the other respects?
Yes, he did.
We're talking with Annette Gordon Reed. Her new book, The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. It's been described as the most important book written about American slave families. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. We'll talk about what happened to the children and grandchildren of Sally Hemings more when we come back and take more of your calls. 800-989-8255. Email again is talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with history and law professor Annette Gordon Reed. Her new book is called The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. It tells the story of four generations of the enslaved Hemings family. You can read an excerpt about the matriarch of the family and Sally Hemings' mother, Elizabeth, on our website at npr.org. If you have questions about Sally Hemings, what her life was like, what life was like for slaves at Jefferson's Monticello, give us a call. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Let's go to Elizabeth. Elizabeth with us from Cleveland, Ohio.
Well, hi. Coming clearly?
Yes. Go ahead, please.
Okay, thank you. I must say one of my greatest disappointments from being a history teacher and many years of studying this time, how much I love Thomas Jefferson and the wonderful things he wrote. How proud I was to teach such a great topic and include myself with these great people, and Thomas Jefferson was one. And I think I deliberately looked the other way because I knew in the bottom of my heart I didn't like it. And when it came to be that he died and even willed freedom to her children but not to her, it was a very sad moment. I still feel a pang when I think of Thomas Jefferson.
Annette?
Well, lots of people feel that way, although... In the book, I explained, I think, what happened there with it. Sally Hemings left Monticello, was informally freed, left Monticello to live in Charlottesville with her children. To free a slave above the age of 45 required writing down an explanation for how you were going to take care of the person and also how you're going to provide for that person. And you had to request from the legislature that the person be allowed to remain in the state or they would be sent from Virginia. And I just don't think that with everything that had happened at the end of his life that he was prepared to write a statement saying, I'm freeing Sally Hemings and this is how I'm going to provide for her, and ask the legislature, the Virginia legislature, to allow her to remain in the state. I think that would have been it's not a exact profile in courage, but if you think about the position that his daughter was in, his legal white daughter, and his grandchildren, that would have been a terrible embarrassment. So what they ended up doing was freeing her informally. She goes into town and lives with her sons, who are freed. They buy a house and stay there. She's listed in an 1830 census as a free white person. The 1833 census, she's listed as a free mulatto who has lived in Charlottesville since 1826, the year Jefferson died. So I think it was a political choice on his part. But I understand how you feel. A lot of people, it's a disappointment to them. But the thing that I think is more disappointing is Sally Hemings and her children were freed in 1826. Esten Hemings is buying silverware at an estate sale in the 1830s. Other of Jefferson's slaves were put up on an auction block and sold and scattered to the four winds. Sally Hemings and her children did okay. They were fine. He kept his promises to her, and nobody bothered her, and she lived her life, you know, and her sons lived their life as free people. The really terrible thing is what happened to some of their cousins, like Joe Fawcett, whom I talked about in the book, who was freed himself, but neither his wife nor his children were freed. And he spent the next two decades buying back his family. And one man would not sell him their son, Peter. They had the money to buy him. He's 12 years old, and they wouldn't buy him. So if I look at, in terms on balance, what is the most tragic and painful thing? It's not Sally Hemings and her sons who, you know, are freed and live their lives as free people. It's 130 other people who, you know, were separated. That was the worst. That was the thing that enslaved people feared more than anything.
Yeah,
was to be separated from their families.
And it often happened at the death of the master.
And that never happened. Sally Hemings got to be with her children their entire lives and die in a home that they owned. And the rest of Jefferson's slaves, many of them, never saw each other again, their mothers
yes,
and their
I
fathers.
Think like Jefferson, she did a good and saw many things that were gifts to her.
Pardon me?
Were extra special. But still, it seems so sad that he could not give her freedom.
I understand the point of view, but I also think that it's sad that his community, if he had done that, I don't think he would ever have been the honored man that he is today, because people would have known that this was true, and he would never have been accepted as a hero if they had known in 1826 that he had admitted that. And I really think that it's his community that would not have accepted him. But I understand your point.
Elizabeth, thanks for the call. Your line is breaking up now, so we're going to have to let you go. Let's see if we can get to this is Sylvia. Sylvia with us from Long Island in New York.
Hi there. You mentioned before that Martha and Sally were half sisters,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted a little more detail on that. And also, how did that play out with Martha? I'll take my comment off the air.
Okay, Sylvia, thanks very much. Yeah, I mean, you have this strange family setup where half brothers and sisters owned each other, were giving each other.
Well, that was what slavery was. The thing that I think is that people have to keep in mind is that this is how you have created mixed race. Americans, blacks as mixed race Americans. It was not an unusual circumstance. John Wales had three wives, and after the last wife died, he decided, I guess, not to get married again, and took Elizabeth Hemings as a concubine. That is what that's the term that the grandson uses to describe this, and had six children with her. But this was not an uncommon thing in Virginia. People would come from the north, and they would be shocked to see the number of mixed race children running around there. I mean, if you think about it, it's very, very difficult. You can't have men and women in a house together living in those kinds of intimate circumstances. Blacks and whites lived together more closely in slavery than at any point in American history, certainly closer than we do now. And so it was a natural thing to have happen. I'm not excusing it or whatever, but I'm saying some of those people, many of those women were going to be raped. Some of those people would have actually liked each other. But mixing, that's what human beings do. And that's what happened with the Hemingses.
Here's an email question from Charles. How did Jefferson's white staff deal with Mr. Jefferson's relationship with Sally Hemings? I'm a descendant of Lieutenant John Key, a steward at Monticello. As the head man, would my grandfather have knowledge of the cohabitation, or were things so secret Sally would come and go from Jefferson's private rooms without anyone knowing?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Interesting Monticello connection there. That's great. I think it was an open secret. Jefferson's neighbors talked about this. Jefferson's friend in a private diary talked about it, it was the kind of thing that I think people would understand. People understand that men have mistresses, men have girlfriends. And I think that this is something that was definitely known in the community. People who visited Monticello talked about how much people in the neighborhood love to discuss this. And so I think your ancestor would have known about this very clearly.
Let's see if we get Charles on the line. Charles with us from Brighton in Michigan.
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
My understanding is the DNA evidence can only prove that it was a Jefferson male, not Thomas Jefferson specifically, that fathered these children. And he had several nephews who were quite a bit younger at the time of only a few of the lines of Jefferson, claimed Jefferson descendants, actually could prove the DNA connection. Of those few, we don't know if it was the nephews or if it was Thomas Jefferson himself. And the nephews had a reputation for being, shall we say, womanizers with the slaves.
Well, the nephews were ruled out. If you're talking about the cars, that was part of the DNA test. They're gone from it.
I hadn't heard that at all.
No, that was part of the test. Cars were tested, Hemingses were tested, and a family called the Woodsons were tested. I've always said the DNA is just one part of it. If you could say one thing that would prove that, you know, a particular fact, it's very, very difficult to do that. It's the combination of the DNA evidence and the other evidence about Jefferson and the lives of the Hemingses, a lot of which I talk about in the book. So, no, it's not the DNA alone. What the DNA did was it ruled out the car nephews, and it established a connection, and you're right, a connection between the Hemings and the Jefferson. But the rest of it is, it's like all history. Actually, you don't usually have scientific anything in history. This is the amazing thing about this. We don't have scientific proof that Jefferson was the father of anybody, not even Martha or Patsy, his legal daughters. We have legal proof and social proof, but we don't even have a DNA connection between them and Jefferson. So it's DNA and the other information that we know about the family and their relations with Jefferson. So it's a combination. But you're right. The DNA alone did not establish paternity. It's DNA and the other information.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Charles. There was a wonderful quote that you write about in the book from Thomas Jefferson Randolph, the grandson of Thomas Jefferson, who said that the other slaves at Monticello had theories as to why the Hemingses were favored, but that the true reasons were their superior intelligence, capacity, and fidelity of trust. Mm-hmm. And interesting that you said it's greatly interesting what he said and what he didn't say.
Yeah. No, he did not say. The obvious thing is that people may have been jealous because they were blood related and they thought that they were being treated better because Jefferson's James and Sally Hemings and Robert were the half-sisters of Jefferson's wife. And then later on, when Sally Hemings was Jefferson's mistress, that would be a reason that they would be treated better. But he just sort of talks about it in these, just this sort of bitter jealousy that without sort of putting anything into context, without even coming close to the question about the sort of tangled family relationships, which was really at the heart of it, because that made all the difference in the world, whether you had whale's blood, that is to say Sally and her siblings, her five other siblings, or Jefferson blood through Sally and their children.
What he didn't say part, you say that the Jeffersons may have treated the Hemingses better also because they looked
absolutely, more white. Absolutely. Well, there was a feeling that white blood, and Jefferson said this himself in notes in the state of Virginia, a general belief that white blood improved black people. And so if a sort of pure all-black person said something that could have been intelligent, it would have been treated differently than a person who was fairer skin. They would attribute that to the talent. They would credit that more. So, you know, race plays, sort of racial attitudes played out through all of this. It's slavery, but it's racially based slavery.
And also that, as you mentioned earlier, we think that looks shouldn't be important, but they are important, especially for women.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And a number of historians, female historians, well, not just female historians, but all historians of slavery have talked about the special problems that women who were thought of as attractive had in slavery, that it was that they were targets for people. So appearance makes a difference. And also if someone who's more familiar looking to you will seem less threatening. And so I think that that happened a great deal, not just at Jefferson's Monticello, but at slave plantations everywhere. I mean, even in France, I note that there was, in French colonial society, a preference for a belief that mixed-race slaves were better than slaves who were all African.
And alien in the sense that these are one or two generations removed from Africa.
Exactly, exactly. That's the odd thing, and I sort of raise this about Sally Hemings because I say she was raised by a woman whose mother was an African. Now, even though she doesn't look, would not have looked like an African, if you think back to your grandparents, I'm sure, and I know from my grandparents, that there are things that my grandmother taught my mother that have been handed down to me, and it's all amorphous, but you know, I can't believe that all of that was, that Africa was just sort of, you know, sort of disappeared from that family in one generation.
We're talking with Annette Gordon-Reed about her book, The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Rich on the line. Rich with us from St. Louis in Missouri.
Yes, I'm a descendant of the Lewis family who lived next door to Jefferson in Monticello. I was wondering if there is any information about them that may have come up through this research.
Nicholas Lewis family. Nicholas Lewis was a Jefferson neighbor who was in charge of Jefferson's farms while he went to to France. So he was very important to the story. Nicholas Lewis, if that is your, I'm assuming it must be your family member, appears in the book as the steward of Jefferson's plantation. He actually handles the sale of Mary Hemings to Thomas Bell, the person I mentioned before. She wanted to live with him. He definitely is a part. The Lewises are definitely a part of the story.
I think you just sold one. Rich, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And here's a call from Charlottesville in Virginia. Fred is on the line.
Hello, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Annette, I can't wait to buy your book.
Oh, thank you.
Neil, my family came to Williamsburg, Virginia in 1773 with Philip Mazze from Italy. We were probably the first, one of the first Italian families ever to come over here.
Mm-hmm.
And the business venture that Antonio Giannini came over to fulfill for the Mazze was to grow olives, grapes, to have a vineyard, and also silk production. To make a long story short, that failed, and Jefferson hired my ancestor to be his gardener.
You're Giannini's
aunt? She did for 10 years.
Are you Giannini's descendant?
Yes.
Well, he's in the book, too.
Oh.
When Jefferson is in Paris, he writes to Giannini and tells him to tell Elizabeth Hemings that James is okay. And then Giannini writes back and says thanks him on behalf of Elizabeth. It also mentions that one of Elizabeth Hemings's, her youngest daughter, had died. So Giannini, he's definitely a part of this as well.
Yeah, well, one thing that we did about a year ago, a lady from Durham, North Carolina, who's a descendant of Jefferson, she organized a community gathering at Monticello, all the Fawcett descendants, the Woodsons, the Hemings.
Oh, I heard about that.
All of the families that worked at Monticello, including the Giannini's, got together, and we had quite a time.
Yeah, I heard it was a wonderful occasion. It was great to have. The idea was to have not just family people, blood family people, but everybody who had some association with Monticello, and I heard that it went very, very well.
It was great.
And I was
next one.
Well, thanks very much for the call, Fred. Just to follow up on his point, I was going to ask, at this point, everybody has accepted this as fact? Have the families reconciled?
No. Everybody has not accepted this as fact. There are still people, and you might hear from some of them today, who insist that at first the story was that it was Jefferson's nephews, the person who mentioned before, they were ruled out by the DNA. And so now the story is, well, it must have been Jefferson's brother Randolph because he was younger than Jefferson. And so that's something of a non sequitur. I mean, men in their 60s can't have children and do very, very often. There's a story about Randolph dancing outside with the Negroes now, which means, I mean, you're looking at me in a puzzled way because it's, again, a non sequitur. We don't know when this was, what Negroes. It was Sally, one of the Negroes he was. I mean, it's just this general statement. The idea is that somebody who would do that, that therefore they must be the father of Sally Hemings' children, and other reasons that are given for it. So there are people, you know, there are still people who are fighting, you know, past wars. I mean, this will never, I don't think, ever gain 100% acceptance by some people because it's what Jefferson symbolizes to them. A caller mentioned earlier, you know, how much of an attachment that people have to Jefferson. And for some people, you know, it just depends on your personality. This is something that doesn't bother them at all. And for some people, it's like, if I believe this, then, you know, everything that I hold dear has been wrecked.
The whole story is told in The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. Author Annette Gordon-Reed joined us here in Studio 3A. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
When we come back, Randall Kennedy will join us as we continue our series of conversations about this American moment. Stay tuned. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.